Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Betsy Leander Wright, who is the author of a wonderful new book called Missing Class: Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Betsy Leander Wright, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
So great to be with you, David.
It's great to have you on, and it's a very interesting thesis that you put forth in this book that we in the United States have not really tended to have cross-class activism, that there's a divide along class lines in activism. Is that true, and why would that be?
Yeah, it appears to be true, with, of course, some wonderful and notable exceptions of cross-class coalitions. But, I've been an activist for over 30 years, and I've wondered that. Why so few cross-class and cross-race alliances to build a bigger and stronger movement in this country? And I just have had a growing suspicion that unspoken, undiscussed class culture differences is part of the issue. And what I mean by that is different approaches to solving group problems. You know, every social justice group, whether it's an environmental group or a labor organizing drive, we all have the same problems we have to face. We run into low turnout, we run into internal conflicts where people are arguing with each other. But the approaches to activism and to group problems, I started to suspect that they really differed by class. And so I did this big study with 25 groups around the country, and I found out that, sure enough, it's actually true that the problems are the same, but the solutions are different. And I think that's good news to discover that, because I think we could learn a lot from each other's ways of doing things and build stronger groups and also build cross-class coalitions.
And so you categorized people in sort of four different class groups, and then you found significant differences, if not universal patterns of differences. Can you summarize?
Yeah, and of course every generalization is an overgeneralization. There were people who were exceptions. It's not like we're, you know, mechanically determined by our class. But yeah, so first I looked at people's class backgrounds. I had a survey that asked about their parents' occupation and whether they were in owned or rented housing and their parents' level of education or whoever raised them. And so I got everybody by class background and then their current situation. So how much education have they had? What did they do for work or money? And so I put those two together and I said, so people are either lifelong, can't say lifelong, but both in childhood and now working class or poor is one group. In childhood and now college-educated professionals, professional middle class or upper middle class, and then people who have been very class mobile. And there's two notable groups that are very, very common in progressive activism. One is the upwardly mobile straddlers. I love that term. First of their family to go to college, some now becoming professionals. And then the voluntarily downwardly mobile. Also people who are involuntarily downwardly mobile, especially in this economy. But on the left and especially in anarchist groups, there's a lot of people who have chosen to live off the grid or not to maximize income, so to put their time into activism.
Or in order to not pay any taxes, as in the case of war tax resistors below that line.
That's right. That's a long and honorable tradition in the U.S., the Bohemian tradition, the war tax resistors, back to the land in the 60s, and squatters and dumpster divers now. And so, the problem I see is the denial of class background. So by not talking about class, which is true of almost every group, the nonprofit I work with, Class Action, is trying to rectify that by helping groups hold class conversations within their organizations. But barring someplace that we've gone, very few groups talk about the members' class background. And so there's a lot of posing as poor and hiding of privilege, which privilege can be sort of a negative status symbol in the progressive world. And I think that's really harmful. So it's not that it's harmful to be voluntarily downwardly mobile, but it's harmful to fail to recognize that, in fact, that's a choice made most often by people from the highest class background. Not entirely, but that the voluntarily downwardly mobile activists had their parents' education and occupation and where they went to school. It was the most, tended to be the most elite. There are classed tastes in group process, in speech, that are being carried out in movement groups and that are not seen as that because we're not seeing the people as class coming from an elite class. The thing about class cultures is that you don't have to have an intention to be exclusionary or be unwelcoming to working class and poor people. You may earnestly want more class diversity and to be empowering to everyone in your group, but because the tastes are so different in things like how do you deal with conflict, what do you joke about, everything culturally is different, you can inadvertently set up a movement environment that's really only comfortable and welcoming to people with a lot of class privilege, so in their background. So that's why the silence, that's why I titled the book Missing Class, because I think it's a big problem to have these sort of secrets.
It's interesting you say that groups on the left tend to reject the myth of a classless society, but to act as if they've got one in terms of having a classless movement and not recognizing class within it. And that because we don't talk about it, we don't have terms for it, so we don't self-identify, I wouldn't know what class to tell somebody I'm a member of. And so we miss it. But it's also very interesting the difference that you found, which were in clothing, in religiosity, in tastes in music, in sense of humor, in sources of where people get their news, but then also in terms of how people think about activism and engage in activism.
Right, and that, of course, is the most relevant for activists. There's class culture differences in the wider society, but I was looking specifically at the ways of doing activism, the approaches to typical group problems that would come up in voluntary groups and that really aren't, as you say, aren't talked about. It's interesting when you think about all the conversations we've had about race and gender in progressive circles in the last 30 years. So we've started to have consistency in what do we call, what are the names for different groups. When you walk into a room, you usually, most of us automatically suss up who's in the room by race and gender. We might be wrong about some people, but we're pretty much right, and we pretty much have the vocabulary to talk about that. But the same is not true of class. When you say class to progressive people, they think the big picture of the economy, who's got political power, growing inequality, the macro level. When we talk about race and gender, we mean the macro level of institutionalized sexism and racism, but we also mean the micro level. We also mean cultural differences among us and those, you know, microaggressions and stereotypes and things that come up within a group, the dynamics that come up within a group. So I think that this book and Class Action, we're trying to add that level of identities and dynamics and cultures to class as well.
So how does understanding class better allow us to get new people into the room, into the meetings, the rallies, the events, to build unity as opposed to, you know, group competition and apathy? And how does it allow us to better interact with people when they're there?
Yeah, I think it's. I think there's two ways to answer that question, and one is all movement groups would benefit by learning the problem solutions of other movement traditions, other types of groups, so just every group could be strengthened by drawing on the gifts of all class cultures. And I can give some examples of that. And the other, and that sort of goes in all directions, but along the class spectrum, the insights and techniques could be shared. But then the other is there's inadvertent domination happening and exclusion happening. So it's not, so it's specifically the omission of the cultures of working class and poor activists that are underused, underseen, underappreciated, underused. I'll give the most obvious example. You mentioned recruiting people, getting people to turn out to a meeting or the rally or whatever. How do you do that? That where is everybody is just the perennial activist question, right?
And of course, Betsy, you did this study during 07-08 when, at least in the peace movement, everybody left because, you know, it was Obama time. So
exactly. It was so common. It was a real movement. It was the pre-Occupy and pre-Wisconsin occupation movement lull. So I've heard it from every kind of group, you know. Every kind of group was like, where is everybody? So I got to compare and contrast what would the core people who did show up talk about when that question came up. And there's just this glaring difference that every single working class majority group had food served that you could have for free by going to the meeting. And many, many groups with college-educated majorities didn't. And the conversation often in the working class majority groups was like, how do we get people to show up? There would be a lot of talk about those kind of short-term immediate incentives, so better food, entertainment, benefits that only members got, self-help things for low-income people, like advocacy to prevent foreclosure or a food pantry, but also having the strategy of the group have some short-term wins, some things like, you know, you can make something happen that's going to make something better in your life or in your community within the next few months, so you really should come help make that happen. Those kind of conversations, it was actually eerie how strong a class correlation this was, because basically no college-educated majority activist group had any of those topics come up. There was no talk of bringing people in for immediate member benefits or incentives or food. And instead, there was a lot of talk about the match between the ideas and the ideology of the group and the potential constituencies. So who is it? Where do we find the people who agree with our ideas or are passionate about our issue? Or how do we strategize to pick a different sub-issue because that would appeal to a certain constituency? And I hate to say it, but I didn't hear a lot of those conversations in the working class majority groups, where they did talk politics a lot, but that's how to frame it to match it to a constituency as a recruitment strategy thing. I actually didn't hear that. So I think this is a both and, a win-win, that by just people learning that, you know, you need to do both. And some of those groups, they're sitting there, it's at 6:30 at night, there's no food in the room, and they're asking, you know, why didn't the rest of the people show up? It's like, feed people. That's my two-word piece of
free
working
food.
Class movement lore to pass on to people who don't know that.
It seems like, it seems a little unfair, or like it's a little bit higher of a hill to climb for groups that are focused on foreign policy or injustices thousands of miles away in another country or grand changes that aren't going to happen this month. Do you have to just start organizing the people in the countries being threatened and bombed if you're trying to end war? Should you just not try to organize people in poor neighborhoods in the United States against war, or do you have to take it to a form of economic conversion to peaceful industries that might succeed in some small measure relatively soon? Or what would be your advice to the?
I think that's a really important question, and I do think it's easier to draw people in who are in immediate need. If your constituency is, you know, your issue is far away, and some of your constituency doesn't have urgent unmet needs. But I would look to the experience of Linda Stout that she wrote about in the book Bridging the Class Divide, the Piedmont Peace Project. Very low income and low formal education mill workers and farmhands joining a group that, among other things, is trying to get the military budget reduced and turned over to more spending on human needs, but was opposed to war's military interventions at the time. The incredibly appealing group culture that they created, that you can read about in that book, that of course they fed each other and they told each other their life stories. They had their own gospel choir. They just made this, they built really, really strong bonds between the leadership, which almost all working class groups do. It's a spokes of the wheel model, where there's a personal loyalty to the leaders and a personal protectiveness of the leaders to the grassroots new members, less empowered members. So I don't think the issue stops you from doing any of those things. Yeah, I think that a peace group, an anti-war group, could follow a lot of good models for having the working class strengths in internal culture. And a lot of that, think globally, act locally. Whatever your global issue, there's bound to be some way of turning people in your local community. It's nothing else than because of the lack of spending on local needs, because of the too much spending on the military. I know it can be tough if your issue is a specific country around the globe, but in terms of global group culture, I don't think that's a, might be an explanation, but not an excuse.
I think that's very good advice, and I have not spoken with Linda Stout in a long time, and I should.
I'm going to
act on that. Another point that you raised that I found quite interesting was class differences in terms of the process used to run a meeting, to run a discussion, to make decisions, and how certain processes can. Now I'm an exception as I would guess upper middle class person. Who hates lengthy processes and never could stand the stuff, doesn't want to talk about talking, wants to talk, you know. But the trend is very much the other way in terms
the
of
the other way. It
class.
Is. Yeah, it's not. That's really good to be clear. It's not that all upper middle class and college educated activists who are big proponents of elaborate group processes. It's a subset, but it is the most commonly raised solution when you have people who are quiet in meetings and not taking on tasks, or they're inactive members, and you ask people, well, what should be done? Either the group is discussing it or in an interview, what should be done? That stylized group processes that require everyone to speak most commonly go around, but it could be small groups or the occupy hand signals. Those are most commonly proposed by a subcultural subset of professional middle class, upper middle class background people, and there's some people who dislike them from every class, but there's a specific ways that they backfire with working class and poor activists, inexperienced activists in particular. And so I think it's important to think of that as a class issue. And for those of you who just don't like them, it's some ammunition. I've heard this great story from the May Day 2012 in New York City, where it was so exciting because the groups that the immigrant groups and the unions and other community groups that have always organized May Day in New York City were excited because Occupy Wall Street, there's like this great new big movement upsurge and large number of people who can join in. And in fact, they did have like the biggest May Day March ever, but the process of the meetings, the planning meetings, I heard from people who are in the immigrant groups and the labor groups, et cetera, saying the Occupy people just got on their last nerve and they almost split apart and almost didn't happen because, first of all, the insistence on complete consensus, even if it takes all night, you know, just really insensitive about the fact that some people have to get home, put their kids to bed or relieve the babysitter or have to get up early and work in the morning, and the hand signals, and that there can't be any differentiation of roles that would imply a hierarchy in any way. There has to be sort of no leadership, 100% horizontal. And that, you know, just people asking the Occupy people, really, this is more important to you than us getting the march planned and having it really, really big? Yes. The answer being yes, it is more important that our egalitarian process is the most important thing. To me, that's just classism. That's organizational classism, because it's taking your own subculture, which you have good reasons to believe in, the tastes that you've gotten from your own activist tradition, which is a heavily class-privileged one, and imposing them and saying they're better. And, you know, it's great to bring in process ideas, but you got to bring them in humbly, especially if you've got more formal education or more elite background than the other activists. So I think seeing how saying everyone has to speak a certain way, everyone has to speak at all, It can be really alienating and really, and now I'm talking not about those powerhouse coalition builders from May Day, but new people, especially multiply marginalized people like low-income women of color or new immigrants with no political experience, that the requirement, okay, everyone's going to answer this question now. And the go-arounds where nobody talks directly to you, nobody responds when you speak, or you have to do your small group report in a certain way, just like the rigidity really gets in the way. And it's done differently in the successful, empowering working class majority groups. Go-arounds look really different. That was one of my surprises because I didn't really know that. That it's like the leader asks each person the question. There is a strong leader. The leader asks each person a question and then makes a positive comment or sound or affirmation after the person speaks and then calls on the next person. So it's more like natural conversation, and that there wasn't as much non-cooperation by working class and poor and new inexperienced activists with that form of go-around, but that one where it's just, if you speak during someone else's turn, it's bad behavior. It's just silence.
You lose natural conversation. I wonder what you think of so-called, and you mentioned this in the book, diversity of tactics as what I hear as a code name for acceptance of some forms of violence, because that's also intended to be very inclusive. But if I think it's detrimental to the movement, is that classism on my part, or is that an acceptable view?
Well, no, I think because one thing I discovered didn't correlate with class. You know, I was able to actually do like statistical correlations. That's really fun. And found some things did and some things didn't match up with people's class background. So degree of militance is not a class culture trait. There are people with more, you know, more sweeping criticisms of the current society and more militant in tactics and willingness to do. I didn't talk to anybody who was in favor of initiating violence. So I didn't run into anybody like that. But certainly property damage and fighting back against police attack. I talked to a lot of anarchists. I talked to a lot of people who did think that was fine, and I didn't get into it, and I didn't get into it in the book. I am of the point of view that I think that I believe in nonviolence as a strategic nonviolent resistance, nonviolent non-cooperation as a strategic advantage, as well as a moral stance. You know, as far as I can tell, that's not a class issue because there's people on all sides of that question of all classes and of all other sort of on the militant to moderate spectrum. That doesn't line up with class.
Some of the advice that I glean from your book, much of which I know immediately what to do with, but some of it seems like it's going to take some thought and some practice, because one of the big mistakes seems to be speaking over people's heads, using terminology that
right.
They don't routinely use. But another one is to be condescending. And so you have to you have to speak at the proper level, but not be condescending. How does one master this?
Yeah, it takes practice, and this is actually in the workshops that Class Action is offering, based on the contents of the book about confronting class, harnessing the best of all class cultures, is a new workshop offering of Class Action. We are going to actually be practicing that skill. It's people of all classes who can practice incorporating the speech codes of other classes into how they frame their issues, how they talk to the public, persuade people to get involved in their movement. There's such a huge difference. It after a certain point, I didn't even have to look up in my little charts what class somebody was, because listening to the audio of tapes of meetings and interviews, the degree of how abstract or concrete is your speech is just this really stark class difference.
But what's abstract and concrete? What are examples?
Okay, so there some people who are second generation to go to college can do entire sentences without any references to particular people, places, events, whatever activities. So you can say, you know, let's set some benchmarks for the strategic process of how we'll evaluate our impact compared to our goals. And that actually makes sense in a certain culture. People who have not gone to college and are lifelong working class or poor sometimes use abstract words like those, but maybe more like one per sentence and one that's in everyday vernacular vocabulary, that there's just either the speech is about something more concrete, like particular people, things that happened, action verbs, places, group names. But even if you need to talk about something really abstract, which of course happens in activism all the time, there's this jump to metaphors, stories, analogies, making the point. So points about conflict resolution. What are you asking people? What do you think are good ways of conflict resolution in interviews? Just something you can answer with a lot of abstractions about, you know, seeing another's point of view, mediation, general terms like that. There's this great speech form that I heard from every race and every age of working class people. Say you and I were having a fight. So you're putting yourself into this analogy role, and you're spinning out an example, a story that makes your point. There was also a lot more use of little colorful aphorisms, both traditional sayings, some from people's immigrant cultures or from African American culture, but also just coined on the spot. Like instead of saying, you know, we're creating some opposition to this very biased court system, someone said, we're a pebble in their shoe, you know? So just more colorful language, more emotion and body language, making that more 3D, multisensory communication, less dry. And I think college flattens our speech down. And two generations or three generations of college, you really get these bad habits. But on the other hand, you learn this great abstract vocabulary for political concepts. It's not that you shouldn't use those. So we're going to practice in the workshop. How do you do the best of both? How do you embed a key concept that really says something like sustainability? There's a whole movement for whom the key word is sustainability. Well, most people don't use that word. Most people don't know that word. But if you start with concrete examples of what's happening, you know, what's happening in our neighborhood or what's happening to polar bears or whatever, and you've got hope and activities and things you're going to do, and in the middle of those examples and concrete efforts, you define the term sustainability and you say why it's a really useful, like if we could all make the economy more sustainable. You know, yes, definitely not that you should never use big words with people who didn't go to college. That would be really condescending, as you said. I think the both and incorporating the positives of the speech codes of all cultures is a way that we could really learn from each other and have all our persuasive communications to the public be much more galvanizing and compelling.
It's a terrific, wonderful goal and project. People should check out the organization Class Action to get involved and get help in these matters. And Betsy Leondar Wright's book is called Missing Class: Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Betsy, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's been my pleasure, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.